Welcome to the Resilient Training Lab podcast.
I know I've got a client at 11, so you know.
Let's get going right into it.
The more we can get into it, the better. Yeah.
All right, let's go. Take it off, Ryan.
All right, I have no idea how I'm going to edit this on Zoom, so.
That's okay.
Well, let's not fuck it up.
You don't need to. I'm a one-shot, one-kill kind of a guy.
Exactly. We're recorded from the top. We're good to go.
All right, perfect. So we're getting started with another episode of the Resilient Training Lab today. Pat Davidson joined us. So, Pat, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I always look forward to podcasts, especially, new ones I haven't done before. I feel like, a lot of times people are looking for great discussions and things like that, but they emerge from great questions.
I paused there, so I didn't actually hear anything you said, but I'm assuming you're talking about Lightning.
Yeah, I was basically just throwing you under the bus and being like, yeah, you know, I came on this podcast as a pity thing for Paul. You know,
I know, we go way back, man. I mean,
yeah, you know, one of my first days was that day where you like exploded your pinky toe with that sumo deadlift.
Yeah, my toe is still
gnarliest. I thought you were gonna lose that thing. It looked like a Mack truck ran over an eggplant.
they sewed it back on, and it was actually lucky because I got a blood clot from it, and they couldn't like do surgery on it because I was on blood thinners. So it ended up working out real well, because otherwise they wanted to kind of take it off, and they couldn't do it.
I'm pretty sure that was like my second week there or something like that. Like my first day there, the first thing I see is Carlos Reyes like sprinting with like a 900 pound yoke across the room. And I was like, what? Like where did I just walk into? Yeah, and I was like, is everyone like that here? And I mean, no, because you're talking about like, a 99.99th percentile individual right there, but it set the tone. And, I think that environment is just such a huge thing. And look, like you can't walk into that. Well, you can walk into that place and leave, or you can walk into that place and become an absolute animal.
Yeah. Those are your only two options. I mean, I don't think I ever got stronger faster than I did at that time period training at Lightning with all of those freaks between
what choice did you have? None. I mean, it's like pure evolution, adapt or die.
Yeah. Between Rob and the Hadges and Andy and Carlos and
Mills himself. Yeah.
Running everybody through the grinder. Like, hey, we're just going to do, the most volume possible every day and then do events afterwards. But yeah, those are good times. And, I think that was kind of the start of it all, where you kind of started to develop this kind of system that you are now, internet Instagram famous for, with rethinking the big patterns. And, that's kind of what we wanted to get you on here talking about, is the whole idea of movement variability. And we train a lot of powerlifters and gen pop people, and how we tend to get stuck in that sagittal plane and what we can do to get out of it. And you're the master at that, so I figured we'd have you on and talk about it.
It is cool, like you sort of you were there for really the beginnings of a lot of this stuff. And because I think a lot of times people, I don't know what people's perceptions are, but I think that oftentimes their perception, what they see, is all there is in many ways. And they assume that, I've always been where I am, and that I've always had the knowledge, skills, and abilities that I have. And nothing could be further from the truth. I would never consider myself exceptional in any area of life, quite honestly. I don't think I'm particularly smarter than anybody. I don't think I'm particularly genetically gifted in any realm of fitness. The only thing that I think that I really am good at is consistently allowing myself, or putting myself, into positions where I have no choice but to work hard and improve. And I put my ass on the line and just try to continuously do that for a long time. And education, professional experiences, and and things like that are no different, you know, and to really test things out on the front burner of things, like actually training this stuff, trying to compete with things like this. Those are really important things that I was doing back then. And that would have been what, 2011 in that area. You know, it's like, it's very different from what I do now. And that evolutionary process, I think, is really important and something that I'm really, I love being able to look back at things and sort of seeing that process happen. And yeah, you know, like you should be a little embarrassed when you look back at your programs 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But, you know, I'm kind of over that. You know what I mean? Like, I bet you the people that like make mousetraps look at mousetraps from 50 years ago and they're like, wow, those things sucked. You know, but if they didn't suck, then, you know, you wouldn't have had to have gotten better. So I embrace that. And I really enjoy seeing that kind of a process. But, you know, what I want to point out at this point, because I feel like, you know, this Rethinking the Big Patterns model has become refined and it's fairly sophisticated at this point, but it was clunky. It was ugly. It didn't have that same name. It's been all over the place. It's been vetted through time and, you know, failures and everything else in between, you know, over a long period of time here. And now I feel like it's actually at a point where it's an incredibly useful model. And it's something that I hope really moves the kind of biomechanics side of systematic development of humans forward. You know, I feel like when you look at program design and nutrition, for instance, I think those are bedrocks of, you know, empirical discipline that have been really well developed at this point, and that the practitioners in those areas can be very successful in guiding people to the promised lands that they, you know, the predictive capabilities in those areas are very strong. Like there's practitioners that can really organize your macro and micronutrients and put you on a plan. And if you just simply follow that plan, like you're going to hit the body comp goals that you set out for yourself with, so long as you're extremely compliant. Same thing with program design. It's kind of like, hey, if you follow this systematic approach, this is well-founded and organized in a really outstanding manner. And when I think about the movement side of things and the biomechanics side of things, I feel like it's sort of a, you know, a mess in a lot of ways. It's kind of like there's cults and tribes, and don't get me wrong, nutrition is the same thing. We got fucking keto people and vegans and carnivores and God knows what else out there, blood types and fucking, you know, the all sheep diet,
Wolverine diet the other day.
Yeah, man. So you still have those things, but at the same time, there are really outstanding individuals at the top of the food chain that have incredible systems. And on movement, I'm kind of like, well, who do we have that really represents that from a systematic standpoint? The FMS was something that I think was big and sort of tried to create that, but ultimately was flawed in its, like, you know, at its base level. So you kind of have to throw that out. And then you sort of have like just things like almost, I would just say the curse of genetically gifted individuals from the standpoint of being able to display large ranges of motion combined with having a level of charismatic, a charismatic persona. If you put a good mover with charisma out in front of people, they'll oftentimes be able to wow and create a large following, but their system, well, it's probably not even a real system. It's probably just a hodgepodge of half-cocked ideas. And it doesn't really lead people to the promised land, and it doesn't really connect a tremendous amount of dots. So my goal here, and what I think I'm starting to scratch the surface of, is putting a system together that is a high probability system from the standpoint of being able to truly hit the targets that are appropriate for people to be able to eliminate biomechanic problems from being the thing that really holds you back, you know, from a multi discipline perspective, from a multifaceted lens of looking at people's moving towards their training goals. Biomechanics is one factor. And if we can discover if that is in fact a true big high hierarchy variable with what's holding people back, giving people a real plan that has clear, progressive, actionable steps is what I want to provide for people and what I believe this system is actually all about. So that's kind of like, when I think about it, that's sort of the backdrop of it. And the organizational system that I put together for it is designed around a 7-pillar approach, where I feel like if people are able to understand each pillar and then discover how to integrate the pillars with each other, now they really are firing at a high level from understanding, you know, both the, you know, the hows of how to coach people, what to look for, and sort of the proper pathway for helping people become the best mover that they can be for their chosen movement goals, along with having a very good mechanistic understanding of what's going on under the hood.
Yeah, I think, you know, what your, the whole rethinking the big patterns made me rethink my whole programming approach, and really does give kind of a, I don't know, almost like a dummy proof system on how to help people reach their goals and kind of like what buckets need to be filled and what buckets need to be less filled and where to distribute kind of training stress to get people to where they want to be. And being able to look at it from, you know, more than just volume and intensity and these basic acute programming variables that we've been talking about for ages, it gives us, you know, these other kind of 7 variables to look at that are important and can create really infinite amounts of programs based on the individual in front of you.
Yeah, you know, you really can't throw out classical exercise science. It's almost like gravity. If I'm going to build a plane, I have to be able to understand and appreciate gravity on aviation science. But from there, it's kind of like there's so many elements that go into being able to design a plane, from like, you know, the fuel you put into it to the structural components of the body of it and the propulsion engines that you would attach to it as well.
I really liked what you brought up earlier about how if you put somebody with better than average or sort of exceptional movement and a charismatic personality, that like it's almost a surefire way that they create momentum even if their system is half-assed. And so we talk a lot about making sure that when we are programming or the interventions that we're choosing when we're working with clients are both efficacious and effective at dealing or moving the client towards their goals. It sounds like these 7 pillars are set up to be both efficacious and effective at improving somebody's like physical capacity. So could we dive into like what these 7 pillars are?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And when I try to introduce these pillars, what I first start off with is just saying that what I tried to do with this was kind of a multiple part thing, but first to identify that which is actually different. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, squatting is different than throwing a baseball. Just because you're great at squatting doesn't mean you're going to be any good throwing a baseball. They're different things. I oftentimes use Charles Barkley as my example with this kind of stuff, where, you know, he's like a top 15 basketball player potentially that's ever lived. And he has the worst golf swing that any human has ever displayed in the history of the world. So it's incredible that someone could be in the 99.9999th percentile of things like running, jumping, playing basketball, changing directions, all of those kinds of things, and still have like the lowest ability to display this other kind of a movement. So, you know, like being able to divide and conquer is always the thought process that I have for development. And that's what I wanted to do first, was identify all the things that are in fact different from each other. So I like pillar 1, for instance, is movement quality. And this does not mean how well does the person move. It's a qualitative breakdown of all of the different it's like the whole training menu from a movement perspective. And it's divided into 3 different areas. There's motor patterns, there's stances of the feet, and there's planes of motion that you can move through. And I came up with 13 different fundamental motor programs that people have available to train. And I have it as breathing, core thorax, core pelvis, locomotion, change of direction, triple extension, throwing, hip dominant exercises, knee dominant, horizontal pushing, horizontal pulling, vertical pulling, and vertical pushing. Everything that I could possibly think of that people do from a fitness development perspective fits into one of those 13 buckets. From there, the other two parts are stances and planes. And stances are a bilateral symmetrical stance, a front-back staggered stance, and a lateral staggered stance. So pretty much everything ever done in the weight room is bilateral symmetrical. You know, if you're doing push-ups, if you're doing bench press, pull-ups, squats, like your feet are next to each other, they're evenly distributed from the center of your mass. And they, when they're loaded, they have a very equal level of distributing your center of mass through them. Front back stance is like a lunge or a step up. They're either staggered in front of each other or one above the other one. And then lateral stance is kind of like a lateral lunge or what it looks like when someone's ice skating or something like that. So most of these patterns can be done in any of those stances. And just because you're good at one of the patterns in one stance doesn't mean you're good at it in another stance. It's like you've probably seen guys that can squat like 800 pounds and then you put them into a split squat and they struggle to just do it with like body weight. It's like, whoa, man, like how is this possible? I don't really know, but it is. Like if you don't train this specific stance in this pattern, you can train the pattern in the other stances and it's not necessarily going to prepare you for this other stance. And then planes are sagittal plane, frontal plane, and transverse plane, which are pretty straightforward. From there, pillar two is the movement quantity pillar. And it's kind of like, well, just because you do a pattern in one quantitative domain doesn't mean you're necessarily going to be good at that pattern in another quantitative domain. So I divide the quantitative pieces up into three levels with load, velocity, and duration. And then load, velocity, and duration have three subdivisions inside of them. Like load, I have high load, moderate load, low load, velocity, fast, moderate, and slow, and duration, long, short, and moderate. And, you know, I have numbers that kind of divide those things. For instance, load, high load exercises, 80% one rep max plus, moderate load is 60 to 79%, and low load is below 60. And essentially, like, you know, you'll have different adaptations that result from primarily focusing on those different loading zones if you're exercising and doing a pattern inside of that. And same thing for velocity. Like, you know, I use kind of like velocity-based training sorts of guidelines for like high rate of force development exercises with a barbell, moderate and fast. And duration is kind of like, hey, if it's longer than 2 minutes consecutive, it's long duration. If it's between 15 seconds and a minute and 59 seconds, it's moderate. And if it's below 15 seconds, it's short duration. And it sort of corresponds to the basics of energy systems. But, you know, it's kind of like I hear a lot of people that like think that they're programming based on actually being able to target like specific physiological pathways. They're like, oh, well, this is this super glycolytic protocol. And like, the, you know, it's like, is it like, how do you know that? What are you measuring to be able to make that determination? Do you have like, you know, like micro, you know, are you like, what are you doing? Are you running light through this thing? You got a spectrophotometer, you're like looking at PFK levels and stuff like that. You have no idea what you're talking about. And the body is like this redundant pathway system that like, it's using everything all at once. And it's like, it almost doesn't matter. Like, it's such a waste of time to try to proceed down that line of discussion that creates like this semantics and confusion battle. And like, it's less useful. Like I would rather use like a very standard kind of like ordinal level ranking divisions and just kind of provide like, hey, do enough volume in the confines of these numbers. And you're probably going to see the sorts of changes that you would expect. And just kind of like use these easier to track numbers to help guide you rather than like very abstract kinds of, you know, biometric, theoretical sorts of things that you are really going to struggle to kind of like parse out and have any idea about whether or not you're actually managing the metrics associated with. So it's kind of like when I'm organizing a system, it's sort of like I decide on which motor patterns I want to include with someone's training. I then determine the stances that are necessary and the planes that are important. And then from there, I'll put them into the quantitative zones, like how much volume and intensity do I need in each loading zone, velocity zone, and duration zone. And it's going to be very different depending on who I'm working with. Am I working with, you know, a nose tackle, or am I working with like the guy that's trying to win the French Open in tennis? Like it's very much like needs analysis based thinking. It's just doing it from the perspective of first kind of having a qualitative breakdown of what patterns. And when I think of motor patterns and stances and planes, I basically think of like what shape does the organism need to move into. Fundamental shapes are kind of different between those patterns. And then what direction do I need the individual to move into from the shape that they've created? If I can categorize those basic fundamental shapes and directions, I have a good first building block. And after that, if I can begin to quantify the number of times that I'm conforming someone into a shape and having them move in a specific direction with that shape as the foundation, now I'll be able to create specific structural and functional adaptations to that organism that should be fairly easy to measure, observe, and track going forward. So I think that's the beginnings of it. And then I move into this third pillar, which is movement standardization. And I'm sort of obsessed with standardization in a lot of ways. Like, I need to know that what I believe I'm like, if I'm trying to accomplish something, I need to know that I'm actually doing the thing that would drive me towards that. It's almost like if I want my finances to go in the right direction, I better be able to have a very clear-cut demonstration that money is coming in from these directions, and I need to know exactly where money is going out in the directions that it does. So that's sort of like the beginnings of that thought process for me. And then I try to really define whether or not people are executing movements in a proper way, like essentially trying to create a ranking scale for did you do this movement properly or not? And I base that ranking scale on what I believe are the fundamental essences of the three planes of movement, sagittal, frontal, and transverse. I use comparative evolutionary anatomy between the divergent skeletal differences of chimpanzees and humans to create this systematic approach towards what would constitute appropriate human being that's essentially like an upright biped. And with the very specific constraints and configuration of what defines the human skeleton versus the chimpanzee skeleton. And I think that it's a better starting point than things like, well, let's just watch babies move. You know, it's kind of like, I don't train babies. Like I train adult humans with stereotypical adult human skeletons. And the skeleton provides the constraints in terms of the movement potentials and the degrees of freedom that are available for the joints to be able to move through. And if I can understand essentially the essence of the design of the skeleton, then I can really make good, solid, conclusive types of statements regarding what is the closest thing towards optimal demonstrations of movement in the specific planes available to train. Now it's a discussion that takes some time to get into, which we don't have here for us, but that's sort of the foundation for that in terms of, and to be able to provide the recommendations, I give sensory motor competency checklists for whether or not your sagittal, frontal, and transverse plane exercises are being done properly, so that motor would be like the way that the movement looks and the corresponding relative joint angles and relationships across the segments of the body. And the sensory would be essentially like, what did the person feel during exercises, or what did they feel in the aftermath of exercise? Because you don't want people feeling too much if they're doing extremely high intensity exercise. Like, really bad idea to have someone become super cognizant of their somatosensory experience while they're trying to do a one rep max deadlift. But after the fact, the next day, you can kind of analyze like what's sore, you know? So there's many ways to kind of look at that. But from what I understand, like, you know, you always look at models and you try to determine like, did I actually provide anything unique in this? Because everybody simply borrows information that they got from somebody else historically. And like, you know, pillar one and pillar two for me, there's nothing original in any of those things. Those are all motor programs I've heard plenty of other people talk about before, stances people have talked about before. Obviously I didn't invent planes and, you know, loading and velocity and duration zones. Like, there's nothing new in any of this stuff. It's just, I tried to organize it in a good way. But this movement standardization part, I think, is something that is mine in some ways, because I did try to create some sort of a, at the very least, binary grading system for trainable exercise that provides coaches with a great window into making conclusive statements as to whether or not the individual they're working with did what they were trying to accomplish. You know, like, if you do not have a standardized skeleton that you're working with, then you don't know what tissues you're training. It's a crapshoot. Even if you have a standardized skeleton in terms of where the center of mass is positioned in space, it's still hard to really target and recruit the primary target tissues that you're looking to develop. But if I don't have a good idea about where someone's axial skeleton is in space, and I'm trying to target appendicular muscles, I honestly have a very low probability of being able to pinpoint and hit the target that I have in mind if I don't have a good idea about where the axial skeleton is in space. So it's that's a difficult one, I think, in a podcast format to be able to really, you know, hold on to and say like, wow, I really get that. But because it takes me a few hours in a seminar to work through that, and it's like, there's a few chapters in the book that I wrote that have to unpeel that onion. It's there's a lot going into it, but it's, I mean, look, like, it's evolutionary and comparative anatomy. Like, that's a large topic to unpack. Yeah, but I love the topic.
You just like went on a huge rant there and said a bunch of great things. I want to kind of highlight some of that before we move on.
That was the professor in him coming out.
Yeah. What's, you know, starting with those first, actually really these first three pillars, I think something we talk about all the time is, you know, that said principle and that we're going to adapt to what specifically we do. And through these three pillars, I think what makes them, I guess, unique is it gives you the opportunity to really analyze the person in front of you and figure out, you know, what they need and what they need to be successful. And then going back into your program through these three pillars, you can be sure that you are hitting those specific things that you're actually after and not just kind of guessing at what you want to do. Like, if you have an athlete that, you know, everything they do is under 15 seconds and everything they do is super high velocity, like, we know where to concentrate our efforts. Whereas, you know, without this system, you kind of are just shooting in the dark and saying like, I think this is going to hit the physiological adaptations that we want, where there's no way to actually kind of measure and manage that. And I think having these specific kind of buckets to fill up and be able to focus your training in on is super important. And even, you know, zooming out from someone with very specific goals is someone with very general goals, is you can automatically see what needs the most improvement or what area is the worst and has the most room for improvement if you're just trying to make someone feel better in general and just you know, function as a human better and feel like healthier. It's like, what are they missing and what can we easily fill up here? And I think that is that value in that organization that you've created.
Yeah. I mean, I it's like, it's funny when I just taught this thing over the weekend, so it's pretty fresh. And one of the things I try to tell people is like, hey, look, like pillars one and two are pretty much the, like, imagine like a football offensive play sheet, you know, like, or a playbook. I'm like, I want you to understand that like pillars one and two, like imagine an NFL offensive coordinator and here's their plan. They're going to take every playbook from every team from the history of the NFL. And they're going to that's their whole play. That's their playbook. That's a terrible playbook. You can't actually manage a game with that. There's too many options. There's too many things. Like, no one would do that. You have a terrible offensive scheme. You've got, like, you know, wing T things happening and run and shoot and ground and pound. And you got, like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you have to figure out the identity of the personnel that you're working with. So to me, a great coach is someone that delimits things down and removes that which is unnecessary. It's like, I give you a forest and I want you to carve it down into a garden. And the more precise that garden can be, the better the outcome and the more organized it's going to be. And everybody's going to be happy. So it's not like I'm trying to overburden you. And the other thing is, it's kind of like, you know, this is a, from a systematic perspective, there's some upfront work that people need to put in to understand it. But if you put in the upfront work on the back end, it's going to make your coaching unbelievably easy. Like, it's so damn easy for me to coach people and to organize their plans now, simply because I did the upfront work. And it's like, that's how pretty much everything should be done. Like, if you can really create, and look, like, I wrote this thing. I am my own worst critic in a lot of ways. And I'm like a vicious trial attorney trying to put myself through cross-examination while I'm doing it. I really try to pull apart everything and find the holes in it. And I'm sure I missed some stuff. I'm sure there's going to be people that are like, you know, this area over here is terrible. But I think that the front end part of it was something that made the back end usefulness of it very, very effective. And, you know, something like the fourth pillar, I think, highlights that pretty well. And that one is movement progression. And, you know, it's sort of like, I look at movement progression, and it's almost like a heuristic catalog that most people have, where it's like they've gone through it. They're like, okay, I've got this sort of knee dominant pattern. And from my experience, I've seen that it's like better to kind of start people with, you know, a dumbbell split squat. And that's just what I think in some ways. And I'm like, that's not as useful as something that could be more principle-based. And I didn't really create this pillar until I read the book Principles by Ray Dalio. And, you know, it's a great book. I highly recommend it for anybody, regardless of what field they're in. But Ray Dalio was the guy that created the hedge fund Bridgewater. And that's the most successful hedge fund of all time. And he's one of the very early pioneers on creating computer algorithms to be able to make predictions on how to play the stock market and what to bet on and what to short. And, you know, it's kind of like the way he did that was amazing. He created a computer system that had every country's market from the history of the world inside of it. And he could put a strategic concept into the system and test it throughout the entire history of every market that's ever existed as to whether or not this strategy would work or not. And he was able to, over time, refine this, and create a number of principles that are almost sure things in terms of what to do financially in different kinds of markets. So it's a rule-based thing that is extremely well-tested. And, you know, I wanted something. And it works across the board. It works in every country. It works in every market. It's not just like in this one particular segment. So I wanted to do something that would be the same. And I created a list of 10 principles that apply to all trainable patterns in terms of where to start people. Or in fact, like if you're seeing errors, go back to these fundamental places. And what I came up with, I it's almost invariably I get 9 of these things. It's crazy. I can't remember all 10 ever. And it's always a different one that I missed. But, you know, I start static. I start sagittal. I start with a bilateral stance. I start by minimizing the difficulty of managing gravity. I start with short levers. I start by maximizing reactive neuromuscular training. I start by maximizing the references I provide the person. I start by maximizing the constraints I give somebody. I start by minimizing load, both from an acute training exercise perspective and from a overall program design perspective. And I start by minimizing range of motion to only the area that's defined as being competent by the sensory motor standards. So with that, it's like, you can like, and look, like you can see when people are screwing up an exercise, you're like, oh God, that doesn't look right. And they're telling me all kinds of things that clearly are not the right feeling that they should have. Oh, what am I doing wrong? Well, all of these things are areas that you can examine. And if you go to where I'm saying with this, you know, you're going to increase the probability that you're going to get the targeted outcome that you said you wanted in the first place. You know, usually there's a few things that have to be defined from that list, like references, constraints, and things like that. And I say that references are things that you specifically feel, like you can feel this part of your body the entire time that you're doing this exercise. And for each plane, there's specific references that are good things to hold on to that keep you in that exercise more effectively. Sagittal plane is heels as your primary reference. Like if I can get you to feel more heels, then I increase the likelihood that you're going to have a competent performance of the exercise that you're doing. Constraints are passive boundaries that I put in the way of segments of your body or your body that prevent you from moving into an undesirable direction. And you know, things like minimizing the difficulty of managing gravity. I usually just say from a simplistic perspective, it's like, it's easier to walk than it is to run. It's easier to stand still than it is to walk. It's easier to sit than it is to stand. And it's easier to lie down than it is to sit. So all of those things are pretty easily defined and you can work your way through them fairly simply if you understand what they mean.
So I think this pillar is kind of one that makes the whole system unique is, I think when you start to get into specific systems and just systems that, you know, people have built, I think one of the biggest things missing from most of them is this way to progress and drive effort. Cause as we started this show off with the key, we all agreed that the key to any success is a consistent effort over a long period of time. And I think a lot of times when people get caught up in some of this stuff, they rob effort, you know, to kind of fit whatever system they have in place. And having this pillar in place gives you that, you know, checklist to like, hey, this person's ready to move on and they're, you know, crushing it here. So let's make them crush it in the next level and kind of be able to build that out. And I think, you know, that's really what it comes down to, right? Is effort. Mm-hmm. And having that pillar in place to be able to manage and drive effort is crucial.
Yeah, and you just set people up for success. You know, if you put people in the right start point and create the right environment around them, it's like life. You know what I mean? Like you put some kid in the hood and you create a really confusing, chaotic environment around them. And then you're surprised when, you know, they're not going to Harvard at the end. It's like, well, what did you expect? You know, versus like if you can create a really supportive environment around somebody and give them a great starting point and some good directions and some fairly straightforward path to follow to reach their optimal development. It's like, man, you just set the person up for a tremendous amount of success. And, you know, I'm always saying with this approach, like, I compare it to teaching a kid how to shoot a basketball. And I'm like, would you ever show a kid the first version of a basketball shot to be a half court shot? It would make no damn sense. Like give them a layup in the beginning. There's nothing wrong with that. It's like the first time they shot a basketball. Like, what do you want from them? Give them a layup and have them practice layups and find some success and have some wins. And then gradually you introduce more challenging versions of it in a manner that's intelligent. It's just that with this, it's kind of like there's a lot. It's not just one pattern of shooting a basketball. It's these 13 different patterns. And the way that they kind of intersect with each other in some ways, like a weird big Venn diagram. But yeah, I'm always looking for the layup version of everything to be able to start people with and to give them really good, solid fundamentals in the beginning that we can build off of. And look, like, it's amazing. If you get people to just make small amounts of progress consistently, they go so friggin' far, it's unreal. But when you put people into a place that's too much, too fast, too soon, you totally sink the ship before it even left the port.
Yeah, in terms of like creating client adherence, creating those small wins is definitely the way to do it and the way to get someone to kind of buy into training for a extended period of time. And, you know, when you put people in positions that are advantageous to their current capabilities, they're able to work harder. When you put people in positions that are, you know, too much or overwhelming or something that they're not ready for, they're going to just not work as hard from the, you know, external stresses of being in a bad environment. And I think,
I mean, who the hell likes to be put in situations where they suck?
Yeah, exactly.
I went skiing one time and it was such a disaster. And it was like, I don't ever want to do that again.
Yep.
You know, it totally alienated me from it. And I was like, fuck, like, I'm the worst. I have such low levels of confidence and competency in this area. Like, I don't want to repeatedly put myself into those types of situations.
Yeah, man. Boy Scouts. We went on a snowboarding trip. My older brother was with me. I'd never been snowboarding. Took me up on the chairlift. And all of a sudden, we're at the top of the mountain. And he's like, good luck. And we have like a black diamond. I go down this black diamond. My board stays at the top of the hill. I'm at the bottom of the hill. The snow patrol comes by and goes, what the fuck, man? How did that even happen? Like, your boots are still attached to the board up there. And that was the last time I ever snowboarded. So, you know, it's a perfect example.
it really is. And we just kind of, you know, like, when you live in the gym the way that we do, you know, you can kind of forget where people like aren't like us that come to us for services a lot of the times. And it's hard to kind of know where to meet them. So I've screwed up so many times. Like in New York, you get people that are such bad movers and they're so bad at exercise. And it's like, I needed to fail repeatedly and often to force me to kind of create a rule book to decrease the likelihood of me failing. But I know we have about 10 minutes and I want to try to finish these seven out. And the nice part is that like the last few are pretty easy to get through because they have less pieces to them. You know, it's almost like as I get further into it, so in some ways the complexity of the topic gets more, and we could always come back and do another one of these at some point in the future, but they're easy to introduce at the very least, where I've got pillar five as movement strategies. And, you know, this is something that's purely from Bill Hartman and something that I think is so far reaching, it's unbelievable. But there's two movement strategies that exist, and they're expansion and compression. And, you know, to me, I think that movement, like, I think that evolution predates biology, and certainly movement predates biology. And, you know, so I think about like, how do things move that aren't even alive? Like there's certain fundamental ways that they move. And a lot of it for me goes to like concentration gradients of things like ions. You know, they expand and they compress. Like sometimes there's like pumps that compress and push them against a gradient, or they just tend to fall into where there's more space in an expansive kind of a way. Or even like the origins or the overall tendency of like a universe where it's like a big bang and an expansion concept. And eventually it's said that the universe will get so big that it'll ultimately start compressing again to come back to a singular thing. And, you know, physics and biology and everything else seems to be based on fractal concepts or nested structure. so that if you understand the rules of one thing, you actually can understand the rules of all things. Everything's based on a simple singular starting point rule that can, if you're able to discover it, you'll see the way that it plays itself out in pretty much every downstream complicated version of itself. But human beings are not that different. It's easier to see expansion and compression at more primitive parts of our body, like a heart and a set of lungs, where it's like the diastole phase is the expansion part of the heart's cycle, and systole is compression. Inhalation is expansion of the lungs, and exhalation is compression of the lungs. And what's interesting is just that we have a skeleton that basically it's a constraint system. It prevents motions in some directions and it drives motion in other directions, but it's still based on motion as originating from expansion and compression as its origins. And so what's cool about that is that we have stereotypical joint actions that correspond to expansion and compression. And it gives you kind of a checklist of like, hey, if someone needs more expansion to be able to execute a movement, then give them these joint actions to help them. And those joint actions are flexion, abduction, external rotation, supination, and plantar flexion. And the opposite ones would be extension, adduction, internal rotation, pronation, and dorsiflexion. And there's a respiratory component to expansion and compression. Inhalation is expansion, and exhalation is compression. So like it's just that, when I think about these things, almost like every movement has an expansion part of it and every movement has a compression part of it. And I think of the expansion parts as the wind up and the follow through. And I think of compression as the middle. It's easy to see with like trying to hit a golf ball. You got to get into a wind up, you got to get into a follow through, and in the middle, you compress the ball and the club and all that kind of stuff. Tennis, same thing. Wind up, boom, compression in the middle. And you can see it. It's like when you go to hit the ball, you're pronating your hand, you're IRing your arm, you're adducting, and you're going to exhale. If you ever saw a tennis player go to hit the ball and they were like, it'd be super weird. You know, it's always like,
It's a lot of moaning in tennis.
Yeah. There sure is, man. They're compressing that respiratory system in a big way, in large part because oftentimes they're not in contact with the ground with their feet. So they need to use one part of it to a higher degree than in some other activities where you have more grounding with the feet. But, it's just a toolbox of things where you can discover, like, does this person lack the ability to get into the wind up and the follow through? Or does this person lack that compressive gas pedal? And generally speaking, I use infrasternal angle testing on the ribs to help me make that determination, where some people are really wide and those are said to be compressed individuals, and other people are really narrow and they're expanded individuals. And it's like, I'm going to try to feed more compression-based principles to my expanded people, and I'm going to try to feed some more expansion-based principles to my compressed people. You know, it's like people that lift a ton of weights are usually compressed, and they're going to struggle with, like, for instance, like the two endpoints of a squat, the absolute rock bottom of a squat and kind of the top of the squat, or it's like it's going to be the bottom of the squat that compressed people are going to kind of struggle with in terms of getting into. And it's sort of like if I feed certain joint actions to people to start them off, I'll probably see them get into the bottom easier. So like plantar flexion, if I elevate the heels, boom, helps quite a bit. If I give them a goblet squat out in front of them, I supinate their hands, I flex their humerus, I ER their humerus. It's like I just feed expansion to them wherever I can, and expansion feeds expansion, and they're able to get into the big time expansion position that corresponds with assistance. And if they do it enough, maybe I get them to learn how to expand a little bit better over time, and I can begin to neurologically wire and pattern that concept into them so that they can become self-sufficient and kind of expand their tissues on their own without me needing to give them kind of constraints and external objects to get them there. Then pillar 6 and 7 are pretty quick to get into as well, where pillar 6 is going to be muscular orientation and pillar 7 is going to be muscular action. And orientation has two components, an eccentric orientation and a concentric orientation. And those are length positions. It's like every muscle has a mid-length, and if I make it longer than that, now it's in an eccentric orientation, and if I make it shorter than that, it's in a concentric orientation. And an eccentric orientation tends to ride along with expansion, and a concentric orientation tends to ride along with compression. And finally, the action part is yielding and overcoming. So it's kind of like I threw out the terms concentric and eccentric as it pertains to the direction that a weight would be lifting. Like if you're lowering a bench press, it's yielding rather than calling it eccentric. And if you're raising the bench press back up, it's overcoming rather than calling it the concentric. The reason is because you can yield from a concentric orientation and you can overcome from an eccentric orientation. And the usefulness of using it this way is by understanding when you can't move into a certain place. So in order to be able to go into the full range of a yielding direction, you need the relevant tissues to get into an eccentric orientation. And in order to be able to get into the full range of the concentric or of the overcoming direction, you need to be able to get the tissues into a concentric orientation. So if I want to do a bicep curl and get the curl to go all the way to the bottom, I have to let the muscle get into the eccentric orientation. If I want the curl to go all the way to the top, I have to get the muscle to go into a concentric orientation. And it's simple when it comes to something like a single joint movement, but it's more complicated when it comes into things like squatting and deadlifting that involve a lot of things moving and different pieces involved. So that's where the discussion gets a little bit more complicated. But from the perspective of at least introducing this model, that is a pretty good synopsis of it.
Well, I know you have a client at 11. So thank you for coming on and kind of giving us the basis of rethinking the big patterns. We'll have to get you back on and kind of dig a little bit deeper because I know this is something you could talk about for days. So
I'd be happy to. We can definitely hop on something after Thanksgiving. Yeah, awesome. I'll jump off now to work with my guy, but I really appreciate you guys having the time this morning.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, man.
Got it. Bye.
We can probably talk about a few things if you want. I think the one thing that I wanted to talk about that he brought up that we didn't get a chance to actually talk about is the fact that he starts people in the sagittal plane and having to master the sagittal plane and be able to put forth effort in the sagittal plane before you get to some of the more, I guess, advanced multi-planar exercises. And I think that's something that a lot of people miss. So,
yeah. So like he talked about starting somebody in that bilateral. So like feet on the same like plane, right? One's not in front of the other. And so like a bilateral squat could be a goblet squat. It could be a back squat. It could be a front squat, but it is still like your feet are relatively like on the same like horizontal plane. And so a progression from that might be a split squat. It's still going to be like a sagittal plane exercise, but there is more of a component where you'd have to control both the frontal plane. So you'd have to resist like side to side movement as well as the transverse plane. You'd have to resist a little bit of rotation. So that's how you can start to introduce complexity in like two of the planes, but the exercise is still primarily occurring in like one.
Yeah. It's like, how do we add complexity without robbing effort? And I think that is the most important part of all of this. That's kind of the what I wanted to highlight in this conversation. So I figured bringing that up one last time would be a good way to end this episode.
Right. And the overall theme that Pat was providing to us was like, he literally said, I expect like what I'm doing to, or what I give my clients to have an effect on what I want it to have an effect on. So he's talking about being efficacious and making sure that the interventions he's giving his clients are creating the change that either relates directly to his clients' goals or that he wants to see out of his clients. So it's like, he's not just throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks. It's like he's being very deliberate in his approach. And the what he got into in pillars one and two, where he broke down stances and loads and durations and velocities, like those are all of the components that he can analyze and use to adjust exercise, like selection and like programming variables, in order to make sure that, again, what he is doing relates like 100% to what his client wants to improve upon.
Exactly.
So follow the research.
Yep. Stop doing shit with no reason why. Like if that didn't show you that there needs to be a very detailed and specific reason why you're doing anything in your program, I think you missed the point.
Yes. The only thing that I thought was amusing was he said you don't want to do things that you're not good at, but we still see Charles Barkley golfing all the time.
So. Hey, I went golfing once, got a whole bucket of balls, went to the driving range, not a single one made it past 100 yards. Haven't been golfing since. Right now, everybody's like, oh, you go golf, you have one or two good shots that make you want to golf again. Not this guy. No good shots.
Yeah, when you take 100 and none of them go where you want.
Yeah, that's the end of it. So that was Pat Davidson. He works out of Hype Gym in Union Square, New York. He does Rethinking the Big Pattern seminar series. So if you're interested in learning more, you can like literally get like three days of all of what he just talked about in way more detail. He's got a book, Mass 1 and Mass 2, which are very intense training programs that put these things to practice and show like you can still drive effort while applying systems.
Shitload of effort. It's hard. Yeah. I don't want to do it ever again.
No. I look at it and I was the guinea pig for some of those. What would you call them?
Protocols?
Protocols. I was a guinea pig for some of those protocols and they are not fun. But they drive adaptation where we are trying to drive adaptation. So if you want to follow him, he's I think at Dr. Pat Davidson, or I'll look on Instagram right now.
he likes to stir the pot. So a lot of his Instagram content is pretty hilarious.
Yeah, Dr. Pat Davidson on Instagram. So give him a follow if you're not following him already.
Good, thanks everyone.